My first meditation teacher, he told me to do this. He said, when you get up in the morning, what do? I go to the bathroom. He said, marvelous. He says, in your bathroom is a mirror. I said, of course there is. And so he said, even before you go into the cubicle, please look at your face in the mirror and smile at yourself. And I said to my teacher at the time, smile at myself. I'm a student. I stay up late at night. In the morning, I'll be afraid to look at myself in the mirror, let alone smile. And he said, do it. And if you can't manage a normal smile, he said, get your two fingers, put them on the side of the mouth, and push. And I had enough confidence in these teachings to actually do that for 2 years without missing a day. It doesn't matter how. And those days, you know, I was not a really good Buddhist. I was drinking and going out with girlfriends late in the night, all sorts of naughty stuff. But it doesn't matter how I felt in the morning. I go in the mirror, put my two fingers up, and I see this silly young man making a face in the mirror. And I would smile, and the guy in the mirror would smile, and I would smile even more, and the guy in the mirror would smile even more. And then I'd start laughing, and the guy in the mirror would start laughing. I'd laughed at myself every morning for 2 years. That is how to overcome depression. Such a simple thing to do. Get up there, look in the mirror, and push. And you can see that's where, you know, now my face has got stuck like that. It's a nice place to get stuck. But that was wonderful, because sometimes in depression you only see the two bad bricks in the wall, the terrible things in your life, all the things which are going wrong. Oh gee, why do I have to get up to go to? What's the point of going to work? You have to really stress out. They pay you, but it's never enough money. And whatever you get, the government gets most of it. And if they don't get it, somebody else does. And if you have anything left, Ajahn Brahm asks you to make a donation, so you've got nothing left to throw out. Oh, it's just, what's the point of going to work? I might as well stay in bed. And after a while, you think like that. And of course you get depressed, but you see somebody funny smiling at you in the mirror, and that's yourself, and you laugh. That turns your head around and makes you look at another part of life which is always there. And that is basic cognitive behavioral therapy, which you might have to pay hundreds of dollars for if you go to see a therapist. And you come here and you get it for free. And it's wonderful to do that. So that's one thing you can try. Try the finger method. If that doesn't work, if you feel heavy when you wake up in the morning, get one of these beds with the springs. So you set the alarm clock to whenever you go back, and the alarm clock, the spring goes up and pushes you out of bed. Do they have beds like that yet? That'd be a great invention. You know, getting up early in the morning. Either that, or it just turns around and just throws you out of bed at a certain time, so you can press the button, say 6 o'clock in the morning, instead of saying, I don't really want to get up, 6 o'clock, and then you're ejected out of bed, like the ejector button in an aircraft. Now that would be very, very good. That's the best way to get you up. So that's what I would do anyway. As for meditation, of course meditation gets rid of depression. Simply because, remember what I said yesterday, two halves of the mind, the knower and the doer? Because we do so much, we've got hardly any energy left for knowing. Mindfulness is so dull. Anyone who's depressed, you know what it's like. Food, even the most delicious food, it's got no taste to it. So the beautiful colours, it's all just dull and pastel. Even music, even Ajahn Brahm's incredible jokes, everything is really horrible and rotten. And this is the reason. It's because, that your mindfulness is so low, so dull. You've got no mental energy. But what happens is that when you start to be still, energy starts going on into the mind. It increases and increases. And colours begin to become vivid. Smells, sounds become more interesting. everything becomes alive again, because you're putting energy back into the knower. And one of the reasons, one of my theories why there is so much depression these days, is because people have to work so hard. You struggle so much just to survive in today's world, that you're doing much more today than you did last year, much more last year than you did 10 years ago. You work so hard. And sometimes you have to struggle so hard, you get frustrated, it means you put more effort into it, and you get really, really deeply, profoundly tired. Which means your mindfulness is not up there anymore, you don't enjoy things anymore. Things which you found beautiful, inspiring before, they don't sort of do that to you anymore. You're dull, really low energy state. And that's the reason why. A little bit of meditation, you literally wake up, energies come up, and things which you couldn't enjoy before, you start to enjoy again. And depression vanishes. So that's a wonderful thing to do, is just to do meditation. A bit of cognitive behavioral therapy, just smiling at yourself. That really takes you out of depression. Here we go. Please explain Vipassana meditation. There was this couple, partners, and they were both meditators. And one day after lunch they decided to go for a walk together. And they decided to go for a walk up Samadhi Mountain, Meditation Mountain. And the partners, the guy was called Sam Atta. And his partner was called Vipassana. So Sam Atta and Vipassana went up Meditation Mountain for a walk. And of course they took their dog with them, and their dog was called Metta the dog. So Sam, Vi and Metta the dog went up a walk on Meditation Mountain. Now Sam went up that mountain because it was so peaceful and calm up on Meditation Mountain. He went up there for the peace. Vipassana, she went up there for the view. She took her camera with her to take some beautiful shots. You could see everything on top of Vipassana Mountain. And what did Metta go up there for? What did dogs? They just do it for fun. Dogs are so much wiser. We have to have a reason to do something. And dogs, they just go there for the fun of it, the joy of it. So, the three of them went up there, Metta, Sam and Vi, and they only got halfway up the mountain. It was so peaceful. Oh, Sam was already happy, even halfway up. Vi, she was already taking lots of shots with her camera, even halfway up you could see long distances. You know, the view, the sights was amazing. And Metta the dog, the more she went up that mountain, the more she was wagging her tail, like dogs do when they're happy. And by the time they got up to the top of Meditation Mountain, Sam, so incredibly still up there, so peaceful. Sam was just so happy. But Sam had a pair of eyes as well, he could see the view. And Vi, his wife, she was taking one shot after another shot. It was incredible just what you could see up there on top of Meditation Mountain. You could see everything, the whole universe almost laid out before you, just there to see and understand. But she could also appreciate the deep peace. And Metta the dog, just like dogs do when they're really happy. They were running around, tail wagging like it was going to fall off at any moment. Metta was so happy. But even Metta the dog, she too could feel the peace. And she had eyes too, and could see the great view. Because the meaning of that story is, on top of Meditation Mountain, yes, there is the stillness, and there's also the insight. And one thing people forget is also the compassion, the kindness, the joy. Because those three things coexist on the top of Meditation Mountain. It's not just Samatha and Vipassana. That is just so dry, intellectual, hard. What about Metta too? So Samatha, Vipassana, Metta, they all come together on the top of Meditation Mountain. So you may be thinking, I'm just doing Metta meditation. I'm just doing Samatha meditation. I'm just doing Vipassana meditation. But
It's all the same mountain. The more vipassana you do, the more calm you get. And the more kind you get, if it's a proper vipassana. But some vipassana teachings, they don't make you kind. They say, take the smile off your face. Just be mindful. Oh God, that's really terrible. Just got to be mindful. I'm not allowed to smile. I'm not allowed to be happy. But real insight. As I said, the Buddha was a happy monk. The Buddha smiled. And then the monks in Ajaita Grove, smiling and happy, said that's what happens when you meditate. So the three of these things all coexist. So you may think you're doing vipassana meditation, but you're also doing samatha and metta at the same time. You may be thinking you're doing samatha meditation, but you're doing vipassana and metta at the same time. Maybe you think you're doing metta, but you're doing samatha and vipassana at the same time. The three of them all go together, for goodness sake. And for those of you who have gone to these places and talk to all these monks, and they say, samatha, that's anapanasati. Vipassana, that's satipatthana. That is what I call gomayang. I'm going to teach you a Pali word today, gomayang. Go means bull, B-U-L-L. Mayang is the stuff which comes out of the backside of a bull. And then, now you know what gomayang is. And I get into trouble because Ajahn Brahm, yeah, I know we love you, we know you're wise, but please don't keep saying those naughty words. And so I will not say, you know, the BS word. So I call it gomayang. You know, use Pali, Buddhism, I'm a monk. So when they say anapanasati is samatha, that's gomayang. They say satipatthana vipassana, that's another bunch of gomayang. Look at the Anapanasati Sutta. Was it 118? Majjhima Nikaya. You just read it there. Anybody who completes Anapanasati also completes the Satipatthana. Anyone who completes Satipatthana fulfills the seven enlightenment factors. You become enlightened. It's exactly the same. Anapanasati equals Satipatthana. So said the Buddha. And he's a boss. If he says it, you can't argue. So samatha and vipassana, they're the same. The trouble is, in today's world, we have, you know, what I call the spiritual materialism. I mentioned that yesterday. My meditation is much better than your meditation. What do? I do samatha. Ah, that's just get you stuck. You've got to do vipassana. Vipassana is the only way. Nah, vipassana is not the only way. You've got to do them together. Nah, that's not the only way. You've got to do metta. Nah, you've got to do Ajahn Brahm's method. Nah, you've got to do Paok's method. Nah, you've got to do someone else's method. That is real gomayang. But people are like that. They say, how many retreats have you done? Four. I've done 20 retreats. Nah, 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 I bet you're wrong. Unfortunately, I've seen that in Buddhist circles. Please don't get into that sort of rubbish. Samatha, vipassana, metta, all go in the same direction. So I don't mind what meditation you do. Because you may say you do vipassana, and I know you're doing samatha and metta at the same time. If you're doing metta, I know you're doing samatha, vipassana. If you're doing samatha, you're doing vipassana, you're going to get insight. It happens. As long as you're doing Eightfold Path, that's what I care about. Eightfold Path is the way to enlightenment. How do we cultivate and sustain happiness in our daily life? Thank you, just keep listening to Ajahn Brahm. Can you always sustain happiness in your life? That's one of the troubles in today's world. You're always supposed to be happy. And sometimes, as a monk, even if you're not happy, you have to pretend to be happy. I'm a monk. I feel terrible. I don't. I'm really fed up, but I still got a smile, even though I'm really pissed off. So, that book, Good Bad, Who Knows, It's also got the American edition. And the American edition, you know what the title of my American edition of Good Bad Who Knows is? I think it's not supposed to be, but you probably find it in some bookshops here in Australia. It is Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. That's the title. Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. And where that came from was there was this Indonesian girl. She's very famous now. Ronnie, her name is, because she gave rise to one of the great stories in that book. Because she was on one of my retreats, and after 3 or 4 days, she came to see me and she said, "I feel terrible." So what's wrong? He said, "I'm supposed to be happy, but I'm not. I feel grumpy. I feel awful." And I was just all these other people smiling that really, you know, pisses me off. And so I said, "Just hang on for a moment." So she sat there, and I went in the office very quickly, turned on the computer, and printed out the first of the grumpy licenses. This was on a monastery letterhead paper, and it said, "This certificate, this license, grants to the undersigned, I think Veronica, I forget what her name was, permission to be grumpy at any time, for any reason or no reason in particular, for the rest of her life, signed Ajahn Brahm." It was a grumpy license. So here you are, you can be grumpy now, you've got permission, signed from me. And she looked at that and she laughed her head off. And that was the end of her feeling miserable. See, that psychology. She felt miserable. She didn't want to feel miserable. She felt guilty about being miserable. So I gave her permission to be miserable. Then she wasn't miserable anymore. You understand psychology? So if you try to be happy every day, you will get miserable. Trying to be happy, thinking I must be happy, that is really a bummer. So, don't try to be happy. Use reverse psychology. Allow yourself to be miserable. Today I feel rotten. I'm going to be rotten today. I'm going to be miserable. Blech. I demand my right to be miserable. If you do that, you can't help stop laughing at yourself and all your misery goes away. It's trying to be something you're not. That's called suffering. Accepting yourself, opening the door of your heart to who you are, how you feel right now. That's freedom. So it's so simple. So don't try to be happy every day. People who just expect everyone to be happy, oh, they cause so much misery in this world. So if you want to be miserable. I give you permission. You know, when I said that, and I so told that story in this retreat in Germany some years ago, and one of the monks who was supposed to be looking after me put that on his Facebook page, and the next day I had about 80 grumpy certificates I had to sign, because everyone said, "I want one too." Yeah, me as well, I want one. I had all these grumpy certificates I was giving out. Anyway, there we go. "Please conduct a guided meditation at the end of this retreat." Oh, if your karma is ripe, it will happen. If it's not, no way. Who knows? I don't know. The future is uncertain. See what happened. Now, look, people did ask me that, do a metta meditation. We've done that before. So at the end of this retreat, I'm going to do not a metta meditation, a grumpy meditation. So think of all the people, sit down, close your eyes, think of all the people you hate. And think of all the things you're going to do to them afterwards. Now that works much better, that will make you happy. And you won't get depressed after doing a grumpy meditation. Okay, maybe. "How can one monitor his or her progress when practicing Anapanasati meditation?" It's possible to explain the steps. How you can monitor your progress, because sometimes people come up to me and say, "Oh, I got into this stage, that stage." And I don't listen to them. I look at the expression on their face. If meditation is working, you've got a happy, bright face. I call it the mouth indicator. If the bottom ones are turned down, no, you haven't been practicing properly. Even horizontal, that's not good enough. If they're turned up at the edges, pretty good. More turned up, getting there, really right up here. Good, you're making progress. Because otherwise it's just intellectual. Please remember, this is deep teaching. The path of meditation is an emotional journey, not an intellectual journey. You find your way into the deepest meditations through emotional skill, through feeling your way in, never through thinking your way in. And sometimes we try and think our way through, trying to work it all out, trying to understand it intellectually, stage by stage, just like it was some experiment in a chemistry lab. Meditation is not like that. You feel it. You have this emotional sensitivity, you know your mind is getting peaceful. Peace is an emotion, not a thought. Piti sukha, the joys of meditation, that's incredibly high emotions. And people already mentioned in some of the questions yesterday that sometimes you get excitement and fear, and that's only just a part of the emotional power of these states. And if you're not skilled at handling emotions, it's emotional powerful states, scary states. If you don't know those emotions, a way to weave your way through those obstacles, you'll never get into deep meditation. It's not a question of thinking about it. It's actually feeling it. Even something like peace. Sometimes I'm amazed that a word like peace, you can all spell it, you probably know it in two or three different languages, but how many people know what it really means? Real peace. It's an emotion. You can't really describe it. That's why many of these things, you need a poet to actually to paint a picture of what peace is, not a physicist. So you need to feel it. And when you really feel it, you get it, and you notice it, it can grow. And so you do need a huge amount of emotional skill and knowledge of that world to develop deep meditation. You have to feel your way in. Don't think your way in. And so sometimes the progress, anapanasati, it's not progress at all. It's ingress. You're going in. And you know how deep you've gone by how much has vanished. Body vanished. Great. So time vanished. No past, no future. You're getting somewhere. Thoughts vanished. Brilliant. Breath vanished. Now you're riding high. And then nimitta vanished. Now you're getting somewhere. So that's how you know how you're going. By not how much you've achieved, but how much has vanished. It's a disappearing. That's why it was Ajahn Bhumali who, he got some of the best talks I'd given to the monks, transcribed them, edited them, put them in a book. And he chose the title, Art of Disappearing. And I thought, brilliant, I couldn't have got a better title than that. The whole practice of Buddhism is about not gaining more things, but losing things, vanishing. Which is why I did actually write the preface myself, and not the foreword. And the foreword, I would say, in this world, if someone calls you a loser, that's usually trying to upset you. But I say, if someone calls me a loser, I say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you, that's a great compliment. Because as a monk, we're supposed to be losing more and more things. You know, we lost family, we lost girlfriends, we lost our money, we lost all our possessions. You know, as a monk, we lose things. And if you become a soul one, you become in those stages of one of the biggest losers. So do you want to become a biggest loser? So become a soul one. And the biggest loser in the whole world was the Buddha himself. He was the biggest loser. He lost everything. So my advice to you is please get lost. And that's what I said in the foreword, the last words. And my last words to you all, please, anyone reading this, get lost. That's what we're doing, we're losing everything, losing our attachments, losing all our ideas of just attainments, we're losing things, disappearing, vanishing. That's the path. Ajahn Brahm, is it necessary to understand five aggregates to become enlightened? If you don't understand them before, you'll understand them afterwards. Five aggregates is just another way of looking at the body and the mind. Just, and they're good ones because each one of these five aggregates, that's where most people think they exist. The body. Are you the body? Is that yours? Is it? People say, no, I've read that in the suttas. I've heard it from the monks. But ha ha ha, when the doctor says, your cancer is irreversible. You're going to die within a couple of days. He says, I'm only 26. Unfair. What do you mean unfair? The body doesn't belong to you. And you only realize how much attached you are to your body when you're about to go. And I always like mentioning Dr. Kesavi Dhammananda. He was a Sri Lankan monk, lived in Malaysia, because I knew his doctor. And the doctor told me, and it's common knowledge for many people now, that when the doctor told him his cancer was terminal, there's nothing more they could do, he was going to die soon. This monk, when he heard that news, burst out laughing. That's a monk. You're going to die. Yes! Can you do that? There's been many doctors here. Have you ever had a patient? You say, I'm sorry, but the biopsy's come back. It's terminal. There's no possibility of you living before another couple of weeks. And they laugh, and they punch, yeah, yes! Would you do that? If you understand the five khandhas and the body, nothing to do with me, you would punch the air. Yes, at last. Bring it on. 2 weeks, can't you make it 1 week, doctor? 5 days, come on, it's 5 days. Vedana, your feelings. Are you happy? Are you sad? Are you having a good time? Having a terrible time? Is that you? Can you really control your happiness? No. You're going to get sick even if you eat organically grown free-range carrots. You've got to be free-range these days, not putting carrots all close together. That's like battery hens. Even if you do yoga and run for a mile every morning, people still die. And they still suffer. And they still get happiness. So, you'll find after a while, your happiness and suffering are totally out of control. That's why I have this picture in my room. It's one of Ajahn Chah's poses. And he saw this as a statue in Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery in the south of Thailand. And it's a monk expressing his enlightenment, hands up like here, you know, finally broken through, finally another arahat, a statue. And the caption is, joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. That's amazing, that's so beautiful. Joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. There's nothing wrong with you. You think, okay, I suffer sometimes, and I must be doing something wrong. I am tired, depressed sometimes. What am I doing wrong? Ajahn Brahm, please tell me what I'm doing wrong. I'm miserable. Nothing wrong. Welcome to life. Happiness and suffering. People come for marriage counseling. Say, my husband's like this, he's like that. So what do you expect? Look, I've been in this business a long time. All husbands are the same. Don't ever think that you have a defective model. Women, exactly the same. You guys, you think, oh, I'll just get rid of this one and get another one. With women, it's slightly different. I think I mentioned this on Friday night. With women, different chassis, but the same engine. That's what guys are saying. They want a sort of a new chassis, a younger one. But same engine inside. It's the same, nag, 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 nag. Might as well stick with the one you've got. So that's it, I mean, just, you're fine. This is a lovely little understanding. Happiness, in your life, happiness, it just pauses between two moments of suffering. When the suffering ends, you're happy. And suffering is when happiness finishes. Suffering is the space between two moments of happiness. Happiness is the space between two moments of suffering. So I remember just some of the happiest times in my life. Finished school, finished university. Yeah, I'm free now. Why was that so happy? Because all the pain of studying and doing exams. Weekend, holidays, yay, finished work. Why is that a happy moment? Because all the suffering of having to go to work. How many times is it that the happiness is just a result of all the suffering which went before? Someone wins, see, the Cricket World Cup. Why is that team happy? It's only because of all the other teams who are suffering because they've lost. It's true. And the more teams lose and suffer, the happier is the team which wins. Their happiness is in direct proportion to the suffering of others. So it's great to understand that. So happiness and suffering, they both come. When you accept that, happiness, suffering, they all come. Now you're going to be joyful, now you're going to be painful. That's just life. Joy at last. To know there's no happiness in this world. That's happiness. And perceptions. Because we try and control our happiness. And some people think, if you give enough donations, if you come to the temple enough, then you go to heaven and be happy ever after. And that whole idea of heaven, of a place where you can exist with happiness forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever, to me, I soon saw through that. That's impossible, illogical. If you can go to any realm at all, even a Buddhist realm, pure land, the realm of the original mind, or any realm, happiness and suffering always have to come together. You can't have one without the other. And I remember reading Christian theology. At least someone was smart, and they said, yes, in Christianity, if you're a good person, you go to heaven, but one day a year, everyone has to go to hell for a day. Otherwise, they would not appreciate heaven. And that's so true. If you didn't go to hell for one day, then of course you wouldn't appreciate the heaven. You'd just be boring. Happiness is dependent upon suffering. Suffering is depending upon happiness. You can't have one without the other. You can't have just eternal happiness. Can't happen. So that's when you understand Vedana and perceptions. Sanya, do you understand the truth? Is your view the right view? Your Buddhism, is that the best Buddhism? Or have you backed the wrong horse? Is it when you find out that Theravada Buddhism wasn't the right one, Mahayana was the right one? Or maybe Mahayana, Christianity was the right one? Oh my goodness, I backed the wrong horse. All these donations, all this meditation. Oh my God, what's going to happen? Your perceptions, you think, I am right. My view is a lot. How many times have you argued with people? And how many times have you been wrong? Lots of times. But you think you're right and other people are wrong. And other people think you're wrong and they're right. It's interesting, isn't it? Why do people argue so much? Reason is because I think I'm right and you're wrong. It's obvious I'm right. You know what I mean? So that's when we get stuck on our perception, our way of looking at things. That's not you. Let it go. Your perception is only one way of looking at things. And then we get to the big ones. The fourth of the five khandhas, will and thought. Those are the two main ones. Thinking. Are they your thoughts? Are they? If they're your thoughts, you are stupid. Because how many stupid thoughts have you had? Basically 99%. But you think they're yours. And this is a simile which shows you what I mean. How many of, say, the guys have been watching cricket match? And during the cricket match, which is maybe the World Cup, maybe, that's right, Sri Lanka was playing the World Cup, maybe they're having a match in Sydney and you're watching it here in Melbourne. And you're watching it on the TV. And then somebody hits the ball, Australia hits the ball, and somebody catches it. And you say, out! How's that? That's out! Why are you shouting for? The match is in Sydney. They cannot hear you here in Melbourne. And it's probably recording anyway. Have you seen people shout at the TV set when they're watching a football match or a soccer match? What about you girls watching a movie? Watching a movie, you cry out, look out behind you! I remember this when I was a student. And I remember the movie, it was Tarantula. We would just go and watch stupid movies just for fun. And Tarantula, it was this big spider, obviously, who'd been in some nuclear accident and mutated and been this giant sort of pathological spider who would creep up on people and sting them and eat them. Really, really spooky. This was 1960s or something. And then during the movie, Tarantula was creeping up on, and it was always a beautiful girl. In any movie, if you're a fat, ugly girl, you're perfectly safe, you don't have to worry. Because the monsters, the zombies, whoever it is, they always go for the beautiful girls. Have you ever noticed that? There was this beautiful girl, and Tarantula was creeping up behind it. And of course, someone in the movie theatre, it was about 10 years old, this movie, they cry out, hey, look out, Tarantula behind you. And the whole audience, we cracked up laughing, we wouldn't stop laughing. It's a movie, what are you crying out for? They can't hear you. You've seen that, and you've done that yourself. Now you understand why you get involved in thought. It's exactly the same process. This thought is like a fantasy, like a movie. And you get totally involved in it. You get excited. You get enjoyable. You get so much. You get really into it. So this is where we learn, if we can only, when we have thoughts, instead of getting involved in it, really getting engaged in it, if we could think of the thoughts or the fantasies like a movie on the TV, and remember you're sitting in the couch at home, it's only a movie, it's only a sports match, they can't hear you, you are not at the ground, you are not in the movie, you are not in the thoughts. And if you can just separate yourself, you find it so easy to let go of the thoughts. They're not yours. You're not inside of them. You're watching from a distance. And that's a great way of detaching from all your thoughts, fantasies, plans. It is like movies. And it's true, many of those thoughts are just reruns of old movies. You've seen it before. So, not mine, so shut up. And the biggest part of the sankhara, the fourth khanda, is your will. Did you really decide to come here this weekend? Did you? Or did you have no choice? How many of you came here because you've been watching me on YouTube? You have been brainwashed. I hypnotized, I put the suggestion in. You will come to this retreat. You will come to this. And you think you made your decision. Sorry. Your will is out of control. You think you choose. How does advertising work? People say that every dollar you spend on advertising, you get $3 profit. How does that work? You see these stupid advertisements on the TV. You see them on the billboards next to the highways. They're stupid adverts. I just saw one the other day on the way to Monash, some guy with his head in the sand, because he looked like he was bowing. I thought, oh, is he bowing to a Buddha or whatever? And it was, no, just don't keep your head in the sand. Buy ING insurance or something. That's ridiculous. But they do that because they know the message has got in there, and the next time you choose insurance, you think you're making a free choice. I'm sorry, you're not. You have been brainwashed. You have been conditioned by what you've seen. It gets into your head. And with modern advertising, they try and make the advertisement stupid, juvenile. They do that because you have this idea that that's just too stupid for me to believe in. No sensible person, especially me, would be influenced by that. That is their trick. To take down your guards, you think, I'm not going to be influenced. And it gets in there. For me, I saw through this when I was a student. Because I saw this advertisement on TV for St. Bruno tobacco. In the days when we didn't know that tobacco was bad for your health. I never smoked a cigarette. But in this advert, there was a guy. And he wasn't a particular handsome guy, just an ordinary young guy. And he was walking down the street of some English town. And he took out a pipe. And he put the tobacco in the end of the pipe. Some Bruno tobacco, and he lit it. And as soon as the aroma of this tobacco wafted into one of the shops, there was this incredible, beautiful blonde. They don't have those in real shops, but in the advert, she was really hot. And as soon as she smelt the aroma of some Bruno tobacco, she was charmed, she was entranced. She jumped over the counter and followed this guy, waiting to do his every command. And then they went past some greengrocers, this beautiful brunette. And she was just captivated too. Went to ask the newsagent, a redhead. And they had, after about 1 minute of this advertisement, had the most beautiful girls in the whole world following this guy just because they could not resist the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco. Irresistible to women it was. Absolutely ridiculous. Who would believe in that? I bought some Bruno tobacco. I went down the street, I lit it, and the only thing which followed me was a dog. No beautiful girls. I'm supposed to be intelligent, okay, but that's how advertising works. Your will, you think it's yours, it's always manipulated. So, this is actually when you see, I am not the person behind my will. I don't call the shots. There's no one there, said the Buddha. The driverless bus. That is shocking. And you're all Buddhist, you know, this is how the Buddha taught. You mean that I am not the person who makes the choices? Then who does? Today, I do. But Ajahn Brahm, who made your choices? Ajahn Chah did. He brainwashed me. Where did that come from? Ajahn Chah's teacher. Where did that come? Where did that come from? Came from the Buddha. Where did that come from? The previous Buddha. Goes round and round and round. That's why the past day and a half, I admit it, I will tell you, I've been brainwashing you. And all you people who listen to YouTube, how many YouTube talks have some of you heard of mine? You have been totally brainwashed. But it's good, it makes you happy and peaceful. So anyway, the last candor, the consciousness. Are you the one who's listening to me right now? What is this consciousness? When you get into deep meditation, you'll find, no, your consciousness fades away. It disappears. It vanishes. Until there's nothing left at all. Emptiness. Nothing there. Ah, where's me? You never were in the first place. So you're not here now. You won't be in the future. You're gone, baby. Gone. Those are the five candors. I've got all these questions. I've only done two or three. Fuck, I better keep going on. Is there a relationship between diet and practice? If there was, I'd be stuffed. Diet. Diet. Vegetarian diet, health food diet, whatever diet. One thing I have known is in the time of the Buddha didn't ban things. Because he knew that one of the old sayings of Shakespeare, one man's meat is another man's poison. So different people have different foods. And trouble with being monks, especially this is the Thai tradition. Is there any Thais here? Over there? No? No. But anyway, the Thai tradition, they have this idea, whatever you offer to a monk, and that monk eats, you get when you go to heaven. So you get what I'm saying. So they want to eat, say, durian, they have to give it to me and I have to eat it. Not because I like it or not, because they want to eat it when they go to heaven. And that really sucks. It doesn't work like that. You make good karma, it's like you make some money. You can, in heaven you've got a bank balance, you can buy whatever you want with that. You don't have to just get sort of durian or whatever. But one thing which I did notice, I got this from when I went to visit and saw a video of a Heiji monastery. This was a 13th century, this Dogen, one of the great founders of Zen. And it's an incredibly strict monastery. They get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, they bathe in icy cold water, they'd work really hard, they'd have to meditate all day, and if they got sleepy, they'd get whacked on the back. Really fierce and very high discipline. But the one thing which stood out, they said the food, no, we make sure the food is delicious and plentiful, what the monks like to eat. And that stood out with all the other rigorous discipline. Why was food supposed to be just so delicious? And the teacher answered, it's because if you eat food which you don't find delicious and tasty, you get bad digestion. And then I just remembered my basic biology. I'll give this experiment now for you. Close your eyes. Now think of your favorite food. Think of it. Like it's right before you. It's almost like you can smell it. Can you feel the saliva coming out of your mouth now? Okay, open your eyes. Just even thinking about the food, saliva comes out, which is, and all this other stuff in your tummy, which you need to digest the food. The more delicious it is, the more these things are actually secreted, which is why they get well digested. And that is why people like Dogen and people like the Buddha said, no, everything else is quite so restrained, but the food makes sure it's delicious, what you like to eat. And that's what I do as being abbot of a monastery. I try and find what the monks like to eat and try and get that for them. And then they don't have too much trouble with digestion. When I was in Sri Lanka, last time in June, the monks told me that it's something like 60% of all monks in Sri Lanka have got bad digestion. 60%. Because sometimes you just give them food, you don't really look at the quality of the food and whether it's things they can digest. Which is one of the reasons they get sick. So each one of you, today when you're eating, what food did you take? You took the food which you liked, because you can digest that. You try for a week taking the food you hate, you get sick. That's one of the reasons, a diet. You know, sometimes what's really good for us, okay, story of Ted. Ted was this friend of mine, disciple, English, from Yorkshire. Was he Yorkshire? It's on the border. Yeah, it's on the Lancashire side, of the border. And many years, good guy, didn't smoke, but still eventually got cancer. Did all the treatments, nothing working. He was going to die. They sent him to the hospice. And when he went in the hospice, you know, only a few weeks to live of cancer, the nurse asked him the first night, what do you want to eat for dinner? So he said, look, I've got diabetes, so nothing sugary or syrupy. I've got sort of hard arteries, so no salt. I've got high cholesterol, so I can't have anything sort of oily like that. And the nurse looked at him, what are you talking about? You're not going to die of cholesterol, you're not going to die of salt, you're not going to die of diabetes, you're dying of cancer in a couple of weeks. You can eat whatever you like. I said, what? Whatever you like. Oily, sweetie, as much salt as you like. Wow. And so he ordered the oily, sweet, sugary, salty food, which his wife would not let him eat for the last 4 years. All the stuff he really liked. After 1 week, his condition had improved that much that he walked out of the hospice and went back home. True story, I was there. 6 months later, he went back again and died properly. But he had an extra 6 months enjoying himself. Which, what does that lesson teach you? It teaches you that man doesn't live by bread alone. You know, it's sometimes a happiness and a joy. If it's nice food, you digest it. So please be careful, the diets. Don't forget, it's not just physical food, it's mental food as well. That's the best diet, happiness. Could you give a bit of advice on how to walk the spiritual path successfully while meeting commitments of a layperson, like doing your job, taking care of kids, paying mortgage, etc.? Number one, downsize your house. You don't need a big house, for goodness sake. Small house, less mortgage, more free time. So you don't have to worry about paying off the stuff. And have less things. Look, I'll go in people's houses. Actually, they don't just have houses, they also have storage sheds as well, where all their rubbish they go and put in there. What are you buying all that stuff in the first place for? How many TVs do you need? One for the lounge room, one for the bedroom, one for the... People have it in the toilet as well these days. And in the garage, TV in there, in the kitchen, so you have your breakfast, you can watch the news. It's crazy stuff. Just one TV is enough. And you don't need a big one. Small one. Mm-hmm. You know, this is Hinayana, small vehicle, small... And cars. Don't need a big car. Get the tram. Get the bus. I don't know why people have cars these days. Because when I was in London, they insisted... No, it's not right for a monk to go on public transport. So they insisted on taking me in a car. We were a couple of hours late. Traffic. If we'd have gone in the underground, we'd be there in a couple of hours earlier. In a place like London, I can't see what the use is of having a car. Public transport is so good. And even for you, won't public transport be okay in Melbourne? I'm not quite sure. Depends where you live. Why not? Get a bicycle. Good for your health.
Go to NBM.
NBM. Okay, you got me there. These carpool or do something. So, you know, you don't have so many... And how many cars do you have in your family? How many cars? How many cars do you need to go to NBM? One for the husband, one for the wife, one for the kids? You can downsize a lot. You don't need so much stuff. And then you don't need to work so hard. And you can retire young when you know how to live simply. How much jewelry do you need? Come on, what are you having jewelry for? okay, you know, when you're young, when you're looking for a partner, maybe just jewelry and expensive clothes. Once you've got him, give it all away. But no, sometimes girls, you think that jewelry from your husband is a sign of affection. That's why this guy, it was the day before Valentine's Day. Then he asked his wife, what do you want for Valentine's Day, darling? And she said, I don't need anything, darling, I've just got you. He'd been married long enough to realise that's not what she meant. Now come on, I want to buy you something. So she looked at him and said, darling, anything with diamonds in. Just something with diamonds in. Okay, he smiled, I'll get you something with diamonds in. And the following day, Valentine's Day, he handed her her present. She opened it up. It was a pack of playing cards. Playing cards has 13 diamonds in it. Well, that's what you asked for, so many diamonds. Okay. So taking care of our kids, paying mortgage. Look at me, how many responsibilities I have. I have to look after my kids too. You guys, you're my kids. My monks, they're my kids, they're my babies. So I've got to look after them, and I've got heaps of them. Not just boys now, I've got girl kids. Dhammasala Monastery, ooh. So, yeah, you have to look after them, but you can still do lots and lots of practice. How much time do you really have? Last little thing before we have a break. I often notice what I call in-between moments of your life. There's many in-between moments of your life. You've left home, you haven't arrived at work yet. It's an in-between moment. Don't waste that. Either meditate or listen to a talk. So don't go listen to the radio and wasting your time. You're at a doctor's surgery, waiting for your appointment. Another in-between moment. You've arrived, but you haven't gone into surgery yet. Sit down, close your eyes and meditate. You are just put the dinner in the oven, another half an hour before it's ready. Another in-between moment. Sit down and rest, relax. You know, there are so many in-between moments of our lives. And once you recognize those in-between moments, you can grab them. You can meditate, you can relax, which means you make use of your time far more efficiently. Tomorrow I'm going to the airport. They're going to take me there early just in case, because they don't want me to miss my flight. And I'm going to have half an hour, sitting down waiting to the boarding call. What do? In between moment. Let's grab this and meditate. There are so many in-between moments which we waste. Once I point that out, you find you have heaps of time to meditate, to relax, to make the best use of your time. So please don't waste the in-between moments of life. And now we have 15 minutes of in-between. Time to go to the toilet, take a break, take a rest, whatever.